Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and I am joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and by Dr. Adam Francisco. We've been doing a Why You Should series of episodes for, I don't know, several months now. They add up quickly, you know. You record them kind of slow because there's only four a month, but so it doesn't feel like a lot of episodes, but it is a lot of months when you start getting into it. So we're gonna continue with that. We did a couple of Why You Should Study episodes, and that was coming off the backs of a mix of a couple different things. Listeners can probably tell I'm avoiding certain topics until we can get the right sets of guests. I think one of the key things with a series like this is that there is a plethora of guests to get on to do the right topics, just like we did with the philosophy topics and Dan Dean. We want to have more guests. So we're going to go back into our strengths a little bit. Some of the things I think we have the most fun covering, and also, if I was doing this show alone and I wanted to bring guests on, I would ask you two to come do that anyways, kind of thing, right? So that tends to be, I think listeners of the show know, we like doing sort of epistemology and reading and the distribution and acquisition of knowledge kind of things. So today, you know, we're going to do why you should read, but I also think it could just be why you should engage with.
Yeah, I think engage with is good. I think the idea of not just reading, because so few people read
today, yes.
But why you should consume information with which you disagree.
With which you disagree.
At least a little bit.
Yes. So that's a little bit. So that's the topic today. Why should you engage with? Why should you read? Why should you consume information with which you disagree? This brings up, I think, for me, an interesting point, which is we do not approach knowledge from a position of neutrality. Because I think one of the things you might be able to pull out of this is that people know before they pick up a book, before they turn on a news channel, before they read an opinion piece, before they listen to a podcast, oftentimes, not all the time, you know before you even listen to one word whether you're going to agree or disagree with it, right? Or you're going to maybe find it disagreeable.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain news channels when I'm in a hotel room that I can turn on, and I know that I'm going to either kind of engage with it and positively, or that everything about it's going to really upset me. And that's weird. You know, I don't love that, but it's just sort of the polarizing sort of world that we're in has set up these information channels that are kind of designed to do exactly that.
Do you think it's ever been different? I think there's a way in which this is really highlighted by the internet and just the sheer amount of information, or even you could go back before the internet, you go to TV, and just the sheer amount of information that we consume sort of passively in a way where you don't have to be an active producer or do much work to consume that information. But in human history, do you think this has just sort of always been the case? I mean, we talked about, you know, Socrates being on trial for death for disagreeable ideas. Is there an era where there isn't polarizing information and the factions?
No, probably not. I mean, our own sinful nature would lend towards, if you are sort of an information person, in other words, your job is to give information, you're going to do it from your perspective. And I think Adam and I have both said on this show at previous times that if we're no big fans of postmodernism, especially in sort of the deconstructive elements of postmodernism, but one thing that postmodernism did bring, at least a little bit, is some honesty. I'm giving it a lot of credit here with the honesty thing, but
humility
too. Yeah. About our ability to construct grand narratives from a neutral position, that's likely not possible. Now, the downside of that is believing then that it's not possible to construct a narrative that's accurate.
Or true.
And I think that's the sort of the rabbit hole postmodernism jumps into from that. All it really means to me is that you have to sort of be honest with your priors before you go into sort of trying to tell a story. Here's my perspective.
I think the difference between maybe...
Which can be overdone, too.
What we would, what we would put out there and what postmodernism does is that we might be able to say that there is a certain set of priors amongst a certain group of people which is true or more true than other people's assumptions, presuppositions, whatever. You might get lucky, and your particular set of presuppositions might be true or more true. And postmodernism is kind of saying, well, because everybody has a different background, a different story, different presuppositions, and all people are valid, and all human experiences are valid, good, real human experiences, one can't be more true. That's where we're going to find an objection, right?
Yeah. I also think that there was maybe, to get back to your original question, I'd love to hear Adam sort of, I'm not sure he's got a historical perspective on this, but he might. I do think there was an attempt, I don't know if you would call it the golden age of journalism, but there was an attempt at in a period of journalism to try to be neutral and report news. I think that's lost almost wholly. I think things like fair and balanced have become a bit of a joke. Because no matter if it's the left or the right saying it, it's usually not fair and it's usually not balanced. And it's usually not objective either. But I think there probably was a time when that wasn't attempted. But as sort of the universities that were training these journalists and reporters got more and more politically weighted on the left, that changed. And then you got the rise of sort of the commentators on the right that sort of were trying to be an antidote to that. And that's now the circle we're in with news consumption, at least.
Yeah, and you know, like commentators and editorializing and so on, if that's what you're doing, fine. But what the problem is when these folks masquerade as journalists.
Yeah.
Just the facts, right?
Yeah, Uwe Zimonetto, this is one of his bailiwicks, right? Is how much journalism has changed, where it's effectively another branch of a political part or a government, and depending on the political party and in power, the media is oftentimes used to advance its policies or change public opinion and so on. But it is much more slanted. I think it's objectively true that the journalism and the media generally is much more slanted to what we might call the left than anything else today. You have to kind of go looking for, I mean, there is right wing, whatever that might mean. I don't even like that terminology, but Fox News and others, of course, but
and some of the new online ones, Daily Wire, what have you, but perhaps one of the problems there, not to get too political, is just the social acceptance of the one and not the other, right? Or the idea that the ones that come from a perspective of the left, which I would generally say, if we want to identify that with something that's not political, I would say a perspective of kindness is should just be nicety, is supposedly more neutral than a position which, pursues truth or law and order or whatever words you want to throw in there. And kindness is far down the list to getting at the bottom of what's good and what's true and things like that.
I also think it's important to understand that this is, I don't like saying that this time is unique, in the broad spans of history, but it is. The technology has provided unique situations that just didn't exist in the past, and opportunities, if you want to call them that didn't exist in the past. And now more than any time in my lifetime, I guess, which is what I can speak to, it is very, very easy to just and this is trying to get back on the topic of why you should read things or consume things with which you disagree. It's very, very easy to just surround yourself with information, that you agree with and that just sort of acknowledges and confirms your priors. And it's hard to break. It's actually hard to break out of that. And one of the reasons right now it's hard to break out of that is because the ideas are so polarizing. If you do read something with which you disagree, you probably vehemently disagree.
Yeah, not like a little bit.
Because it's so on the other side of what you're thinking, instead of sort of just being, a little bit off. I often tell you guys that when it comes to like political podcast consumptions, I'm kind of a fan of listening to ones that I disagree with about 20%, just because it keeps me honest. I'm not a uber fan of listening to things that just confirm all of my priors, because it's just so easy. And it's just, I'm just sitting there nodding my head. Yep. Okay. Well, I didn't learn anything about anybody else's position that I didn't already know or feel or believe. And I think the same can be said for reading theological material.
I was going to say this, the way I think we could bring this into sort of like, what we do on theology and history and stuff is that as we become polarized and we become used to sort of circling the wagons for various bad and maybe even good reasons of sort of, picking a group and sticking with it, you begin to apply that not just to like political affiliations now or watching TV or media or listening to stuff, but then you could do that, and because your experience is just the things you already agree with, you go back, you look at the Reformation, you're a Lutheran like us, and you go, I already disagree with Calvinism. I'm not going to read the Institutes. I'm not going to read the Institutes. Yeah. I'm not going to read Calvin. I'm not going to read any of the things I know I disagree with already.
Not going to read Zwingli.
You then get to to something that's a little more important than, what laws should be passed in your city, at least big, which is what is true about Scripture, the Bible, and the Christian faith. Do any of these disagreements matter? If they do, shouldn't you explore the disagreeing opinions? It might also help you figure out to what degree the disagreements do matter or not, right? Maybe something is, maybe something you believe is wrong as a Lutheran is wrong with Calvinism is a little overblown. Maybe there's something you've taught is a minor issue, which you're reading and you find out should be bigger, right? There's all sorts of problems with this.
What were you going to say, Adam?
Since you mentioned the Reformation, I think I've quoted Luther on this before, but there's this, something I find really refreshing with him, even though he can be bombastic and hyperbolic and polemical always, he, especially in his letters and more personal writings or in the table talks, where people are recording what he's saying and stuff, even though he doesn't necessarily want them to be recording or writing down, but he would always ask himself the question from the get-go, am I the only one that's wise? Yeah. Am I alone wise? Why is it that nobody else is seeing this? It's only me. And that comes from I think it's fair to say a position of epistemic humility, recognizing that certainly Luther believed there are things that were true and good and beautiful, but he also knew full well that he might not have the full story or all the facts. He also certainly knew full well that he was by nature sinful and unclean, it would skew, or his interpretation of facts probably was oftentimes a way to confirm his bias and so on and so forth. So even you don't really see it in his polemical or public writings, but throughout the course of his career, he approached things with a tinge of, if you will, skepticism. He had it's minor, but still, I think that's quite healthy.
I also think something like the Reformation cannot happen without people like Luther and Melanchthon reading actually so well sources and individuals who they disagreed with. It just doesn't happen, right? The Reformation doesn't happen if Luther, doesn't read Aquinas, with whom he massively disagrees.
Well, it doesn't. I mean, some of Luther's greatest work doesn't happen unless he actually reads Erasmus' treatment of the freedom of the will.
Right.
Right. And I think the mistake can be made that somebody might say, well, read stuff that you disagree with so that you can be argued into their position. I'd say, well, maybe. But maybe just so that you can know the argument and know it well. Maybe it's so that you can understand the perspective so that when you do try to convince another person of your position, you're treating their position with honesty, which is doesn't happen very much right now today, not in theology or in politics or anywhere else. I mean, what if you actually sort of understood your opponent's argument before you started debating them? I mean, think of that. That'd be crazy.
That would be crazy.
Yeah.
What I see, and I mean, this is just my perspective, maybe even just my opinion, but in our day and age, because so many on either side of the political and other aisles consume information for the sake of confirming their bias and getting riled up, you know, and so on, I really think we live in an age of ideology in the sense that everybody is now finding themselves in these tribes or these camps, and they're warring camps, at least in terms of a cultural war, if you will. And how refreshing it is. And to go to the original question, why should you read or consume information with which you disagree? It's useful to read or consume information so you know what the other side or your I'm using air quotes for those listening, opponents are saying and thinking. But also, I really do believe, I don't think, like you said, Caleb, or maybe it was you, Scott, that there is no view from nowhere. That is, there is no perfectly objective view out there. But if we really are committed to pursuing and acknowledging or confessing the truth, we should always be open. And this is what Rod Rosenblatt taught us, as you know, Scott. Always be open to the fact that you might be wrong.
Yeah.
So keep pursuing it.
Right, yeah. Always be willing to change your position if you can be shown to be wrong.
Right.
I think,
and that's something that's gone away in this sort of, I don't know when it happened. I don't know if it was the 1960s or whatever. I don't know whether it's postmodernism. I don't know what it, or it's critical theory, whatever it is. But the spirit of early modernity, the age of Luther and company, and even into the Enlightenment, is if somebody encountered ideas or facts that overthrew or challenged what they thought was true, they would change their position.
Yeah,
maybe not right away, but slowly.
Get blown about by every sort of wind that might change, but it means be thoughtful and be sort of epistemologically empirical and open to new data being brought forward. I mean, we should do this on everything. We should even do this on our theological positions. I mean, I'm grounded in sort of my confessional Lutheranism, but at the same time, I like to hear arguments for other positions. Oftentimes, just because it makes me stronger in my own position, but sometimes because it makes me think. I mean, Daniel Emery Price and I are doing a new podcast/radio show called Tough Text, where we take some of the crazier texts in the Bible and try to provide some clarity to them. Mm-hmm. And there's some crazy stuff going on in the Bible. Like, there's some crazy stuff going. We just did today the Witch of Endor, where Saul, consults a medium to raise the spirit of Samuel.
I'm curious what you guys have to say about that. Those texts to me are this crazy warning about how, like, why the second commandment about not doing witchcraft is like a real deal. Like, this is not, like, you should not do witchcraft. It works sometimes. And
I did say that, but there's a little more going on. I think there's a little more going on there, including a promise to Saul that he would be with Samuel tomorrow. So he was going to be killed, but that didn't mean he was going to hell. He was going to be with Samuel, who is with
very
God.
Interesting.
But at the end of the day, you know, some of that you read, and you if you were in your 20s, like, I'm this and I'm going to fight the whole world against this. For me, it's a little bit the older I get, not that I soften in my positions, but I read some of that stuff and you can understand why people have different opinions about it, because it's not as straightforward in every line as you might think it is if you only study one side of a particular object or a particular position, especially when it comes to biblical theology.
Yeah, I have a friend who, you know, was talking about, as you know, reading different like preaching examples or homiletic stuff and getting upset when somebody's like, this is the only way you can preach this one text, right?
Yeah.
It's saying like, there's only one way, you know, this whole section taken out for a lectionary in the Bible can be read this week is very limiting scope.
We had my pastor, when the past Pentecost, preached on the Tower of Babel in relation to Pentecost, which that's how the readings go. So that's pretty common. And you can, you know, there's really bad preaching, I think, on the Tower of Babel. And there can be some really good stuff. And the really good stuff is typically has to do with the people sort of chasing after their own way and God confusing their language to get them back on track. And then at Pentecost, you know, bringing back everybody back under one understanding, one language for the sake of the gospel, because now the promise is fulfilled. And I've heard some of that good stuff before too, but Bob Hiller, my pastor this past weekend, you know, connected it expressly to something that I hadn't really thought of, which is Noah and the flood and the command once more to be fruitful and multiply and populate the entire earth. And when they decided to stay in this one fertile valley, they weren't listening to the be fruitful and multiply and populate the whole earth. And I thought, wow, that's, I mean, this is just one example, right, of where you can have five really smart people that you probably mostly agree with on things, and one person can see something there that you didn't see. Now, if you're not reading broadly, even with stuff that's a little off kilter for you, you're never going to encounter that one person that saw something that you didn't see.
Yeah. I think there's a level today as we, like, explore the you know, potential reasons why this gets increasingly worse. We did an episode on expertism a while ago, I think last fall.
Where we acknowledged that Adam was an expert.
Yeah, that's right. And,
I don't remember that, but thank you.
As I think about that in relation to this, I think there's a level of temptation to release yourself from the personal responsibility of the implications and consequences of your ideas, beliefs, and ideologies. Because if you only are reading one side or you've predetermined this stuff, it's, if something goes wrong with that, if those ideas end up being wrong or harming somebody, it can be somebody else's fault. It can be the expert's fault, the tribe's fault. And that can be across the political spectrum, right? If you assign yourself to a camp, it's easy to allow all of your beliefs to come from somebody else. You don't have to analyze. So even if there's not negative consequences, there's a level of risk involved with making decisions and deciding what to believe that you get to export. And there's a big temptation to that. Think about all the anxiety over like school or being right that people have in my generation and the generations below me, that they keep communicating that, you know, they're worried that they're wrong, they're making the wrong decisions, they have this. If you just find somebody who's a little smarter than you and you let them make those decisions for you, it's easy to just then become a warrior for that cause than to...
Because they saved you.
Yeah, because they saved you from all that anxiety, that risk, that terror of facing the world. Now what your job is to be loyal to the person who pulled you out of that despair. And I think that happens, I mean, that happens left and right, right?
I think that happens a lot when people get into college and they meet inspiring college professors that sort of lead them down a path. And sometimes that path is a very good path that they get led down, and sometimes it's a more harmful path. But it's very difficult when you're in your 20s, when you become sort of enlightened about a particular subject or a series of subjects and are inspired to find the points that you know, with which you should disagree in that. And I think it's important to still try to do that, but it's, you know, it's probably not even that possible at that point. But it does, if you sort of go into that with a little humility. I mean, we call people in their sophomore year sophomoric for a reason, right? they've learned just enough by their sophomore year to know more than everybody else. And so they come home and they correct their parents on everything, all their political positions, on their watering habits or their waste habits or the fact that they don't recycle enough or whatever. And, you know, and you can easily say, well, that's sophomore. And this, but it's passion, you know, it's passion that's not being checked by a sense of humility. And that's a difficult thing. It's hard to be humble. I think for everybody, it's hard to be humble, not just for people that are smart or successful or whatever. I think for everybody, it's hard to be humble. That's part of being sinful. But it's important. It's important if you actually want to try to have an accurate picture of what's going on around you.
Yeah, I do think there's something to something you said. There's something to something that you said towards the beginning of the show, which was about finding stuff you disagree with about 20%. Now, I'm interested in this and the discovery of these kinds of things because, like you said, leading into that, it's often that the disagreement isn't minor, right? And I find it, for me, hard, if not painful, to listen to things I disagree with as they caricaturize my own positions as just repeated over and over again what's wrong with them without having any real information, facts, history, citations at all about what the position actually is. And so, you know, I probably listen to things I agree with a little more than you do. But part of that for me is a relief or a break from seeing I'm online just a smidge more in some cases, the just mass disagreement with your position all the time, right? Like seeing things like...
Can I say perceived mass disagreement because it's all online?
Yeah, sure. Perceived. Ooh, I mean, who knows how many of it is bots, but occasionally you'll see something...
I don't even mean that. I mean in the sense of online consumption. I mean, there's pretty good studies on the fact that the most vocal people online, if you take both sides, equate to about, it's like 2.2% of the population in general, even of the online population. So I don't know the actual numbers, but let's say there's, wow, how many millions of people are on Facebook? The 300 million, I don't know, it's probably way more than that. But the things that you see that are driving you crazy, you know, equate to probably less than 2% of the number of people that are actually propagating information online. But I think it gives you the sense, especially if you're getting all this negative information towards your own beliefs and position, that the whole world is against you.
Or a huge chunk of it is. And then you get so then you go seek refuge at least with somebody who gets what you're up to.
Right. The vocal 2% that are on your side.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I mean, I don't know how to tell you to do that differently. Cause that's just sort of how things work right now. I just don't think it's the most useful for getting an actual accurate picture of where your neighbor is that you might run into on your block or at the grocery store or on the ski slope or whatever. You know, I'm not sure it actually gives you an accurate picture of where they are.
Right.
Theologically, politically, morally, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I got completely speechless and dumbfounded and had no idea how to respond to somebody recently. I'm selling a house. Guy who the young guy who comes and takes pictures of the house, he's like a lot of my creative photographer friends. He's talking to me about stuff, sees my bookshelf, sees the Christian books on the bookshelf, and tells me about how he's kind of, you know, classic millennial, kind of religious, but he doesn't want to pick one.
And then he might be wrong.
Well, yeah. No, and then I heard it like something I've never heard before.
Here we go.
Which was, my problem with Christians is that they're just so sure that they're saved. And I'm like, assurance, I'm a Lutheran, what am I supposed to say to this guy? My whole shtick is that you should be sure, you know.
That's because my assurance isn't about me.
Right.
And if it were, I'd be confused all the time, too.
And I was just, like, sitting there going,
You know, it's hard when you're actually in those situations.
But it's interesting, right? Because I kind of realize, like, I have spent so much time talking to people in the last couple of years, and the focus for us being people who struggle with their assurance. Now, that's part of the mission of 1517, right? Is to assure people in Christ crucified, dead and risen for them, that I had this brain fart because I hadn't engaged with the other portion of this, which is somebody mad at assurance.
Right.
You know, so even there, there's like a time bias of my energy spent preparing or reading material about X has decreased about something that I forgot to care about anymore, which was somebody on this flip side of the coin.
Yeah, there's an interesting, not that you would have ever had time, but there's an interesting exercise with somebody like that that has to do with, well, how are you sure about anything? Like, how are you sure about,
right, exactly,
you know, walking into this house that it's not going to fall down? How are you sure about getting in your car? How are you sure that
he shouldn't have been his,
the pictures that you're taking are actually going to show up on the screen the way you want them to? All of this stuff, you know, we walk around this world with a whole lot of assurance, and a lot of it's probably unfounded in a lot of ways, but it's still, we still act on it. More so than, I think, in a lot of ways, than people who have become sure of the Christian claim that mm-hmm. Christ was their savior and died for their sins and rose again for their justification.
Yeah, no. I mean, this guy probably shouldn't have been sure. Maybe he wasn't of a whole lot. He was limping around my house because he crashed his electric bike, and I went outside and looked at it, and you could tell why. The tires were bald and all the way down to threads. Right, so I was like, okay, very observant.
Well, according to your dad, I'm putting words into his mouth, one shouldn't even have an electric bike in the first place. Yeah. I toy with getting one a couple times, and every time I text your dad, because he always seems to be right on things. So now he's like sort of the guy I run things through, and last time I text, he says, don't get one. So I won't tell you why, but...
Well, I think I was misunderstanding what the purpose of your electric bike was.
I don't need an electric bike.
Yeah.
I got two legs.
There you go.
No, this is interesting. I will occasionally put myself through this painful exercise of reading things I disagree with. The most recent time that I put myself through days of horrific pain was when, like, the Roe v. Wade leak happened, and I was reading, my Apple News would give me these news articles from all the major newspapers about it, and it was one of the most painful three-day experiences I ever had reading these.
There was a lot of mistaken information that came out connected mm-hmm. to that.
Yeah. So that was difficult, but I did it. I will.
That was a good example of one of my sources that you don't like that I usually... you know, find 20% off kilter, sort of gave a very balanced analysis of that, you know, that most of which has shown to be pretty accurate. I didn't sit there and love every second of it. But.
Scott, can I ask you a question in terms, you know, with reference to the question Caleb started with? Do you read, I'm sure you do, literature attacking Christianity? I know you read like Calvinists, and
I'm more so in the past. It's actually one of the areas that I think if I continue doing speaking gigs on apologetics, I've got to get better at keeping up to date on. I read enough in the past to sort of know, I think, most of the general arguments, modern incarnations of those, even when I kind of touch base with them, even all seem to be variations of the same thing. Anyway, so, but yeah, I think some of them given to a person who's on the fence are maybe a little bit confusing, mostly because a lot of them play to emotion. But you know, if there was a new one that came out that was groundbreaking, or the people were saying was groundbreaking and a real danger, real threat, I'd certainly read it.
Yeah. Sometimes I wonder how healthy it is from my own experience, or lived experience, as they say now, because I read quite a bit of this stuff, you know, attacks on Christianity or the skeptics and so on. And I do it to learn the arguments, but oftentimes the arguments stink. So it's like, that was a waste of time. But sometimes I have, well, not sometimes, oftentimes, and we have a mutual friend who's kind of like this as well, where I'm not trying to talk myself out of Christianity. I'm not trying to talk myself out of believing that Jesus really physically and bodily or historically rose from the dead, but I'm always challenging my beliefs. So I will sometimes select texts that I think are, at least because I've heard or they've been advertised as such, that this is like the argument against the resurrection of Jesus. And I sometimes think, should I admit that to people, which I am right here, because how healthy is that?
Yeah.
But the remarkable thing is when I read this stuff, I think, wow, these groundbreaking arguments or these robust arguments really stink.
Yeah.
but rhetorically, they might be interesting and kind of fun. For example, Sam Harris, one of those, what used to be called the New Atheist movement, you know, he has a way with words. If you look at the argument and especially the assumptions that are oftentimes not even stated in the argument, you're like, this stinks. And so back to that original question, I find that reading stuff with which you would disagree with in like the theological realm actually does quite strengthen your resolve or your faith, if you will.
This happens. One of the reasons I kind of like the historical and systematic theology is there's often a source to go check when you have disagreements with people. And so, you know, it has been slowing down over the years, but you know, for years there was the only thing Lutherans could talk about was 30s law controversy stuff. And occasionally this
has
still
that been slowing down.
Oh, I guess a little bit. It resurges, right? Every time it resurges, I'll go read the articles that are being published in various Lutheran journals. I'll go read the positions that I know disagree with mine and are in fact sometimes targeting people like us, but not by name or whatever. And I'll read these footnotes and they'll, you know, footnote, say, Article 6 of the formula. And every time this happens, my habit is to go, have I been reading the formula wrong this whole time? You know, like, and go reread it, right? Go reread not just the section they cite, but the whole thing. And so far I've come out going, okay, I'm in the clear, but it, you know, it causes me every single time somebody makes one of these arguments, I often do what Adam was saying and say, doubt my own bias because I have a particular thing I want to be true. And so I'll read these articles and then it'll prompt me to go reread. I can't tell you how many times I've reread the Formula of Concord in the last several years because of arguments like this.
I do think there's a point at which I'm say two things. One, let me just say them first and then kind of explain them. I do think there's a time to wipe the dust off of your feet with some of this stuff.
I really do.
I don't necessarily think it's healthy. We are arguing on this show for engaging the arguments and for engaging the disagreements. But if you know, one of the arguments has been sort of soundly refuted, and yet they keep making it the same one without variation, you don't have to continually reread that. You've done that. You've done your homework. Mm-hmm. You've done your due diligence. There's no need to continue to frustrate yourself or make yourself believe that their position is bigger or more sort of publicly believed than it actually is. The second one to Adams on the, you know, arguments against the faith. That whole thing is interesting to me because I really do believe that most of those boil down to some emotion at some point. And the emotion is that I just don't want to believe that this is true. Because that's going to have an implication for my life. So much so that people will believe even sort of suggest other outrageous explanations. Aliens, for example, instead
that's what I was thinking. Aliens sucking up the body of Jesus into their spaceship.
Instead of the actual resurrection, because if it's a resurrection of Christ from the dead, that has an actual implication on their life, right? As Montgomery says in Sensible Christianity, right? You're now at a turning point. You have to make a decision. Now, don't get me on the decision theology stuff because That's not what I'm saying. But we're talking in sort of evangelistic venues. You're facing the cross, and there it is. It's funny. I was listening to a mountain biking podcast, and these guys are all from the Pacific Northwest, and they're all just, I'm sure, just like,
yeah,
typical Pacific Northwest
outdoor type.
Outdoor type, in all of that means unbelievers. These guys actually had a serious conversation on whether or not you should ride the most difficult mountain bike trails that you can find high or not. So, you know, and I'm sure they don't believe anything, right? But they started out their show today by having a very serious conversation about superstitions. Like, and do you believe in aliens? And would you walk under a ladder? And what do you do if a black cat crosses your path? And I'm like, I'm sitting there just thinking to myself, I guess I shouldn't guarantee you, but my suspicion is that they would not engage a serious argument for the resurrection of Christ out of hand because of whatever they were taught in high school and college or whatever, that it's just not possible.
You'd have a lot of work to do before that.
For these things to happen. Yet they'll engage these other things that sort of play to their emotions and their emotional biases anyway. And I just think, yeah, that's just funny. It's just interesting how people work.
I shouldn't probably mention this because I don't remember the title of the book, but not too long ago I read this book on the scientific revolution, so mid 19th century to the into the 20th century, and the argument in the book was we all assume it was challenging what's called the secularization thesis, which is this basically an argument that says as science advances in a society, religious belief declines, in particular, institutional religious belief. And the author documents all these high-profile scientists from the mid-19th century to the 20th century and how, while publicly they operated as materialists or atheists or whatever, by night they're going and consulting their astrologer or their palm reader or engaging some sort of occultic seance or something like that. So,
of course.
It's fascinating, you know, these very sophisticated, seemingly people who, I don't know if mountain bikers are sophisticated, but yet they're willing to entertain this bizarre stuff, Gnostic kind of stuff. But when it comes to something that's pretty well documented, because it is well documented and historically has been a driving force in Western civilization, they dismiss it out of hand. That, if I can be honest, infuriates me.
No, that's what I was saying. That was my point, is that that type of thing is infuriating because you know that you're not going to, you don't know, I should stop saying no. You strongly suspect that if you were to sit down and get a beer with these people and want to have a serious conversation about the evidence for the death and resurrection of Christ, that it would be dismissed out of hand as not possible. As maybe a sort of, curtain over the fact that it's not that they think it's not possible really, but that it just doesn't fit sort of their lifestyle or what they think will be required of them morally if they're convinced of this or whatever. But they use sort of the background of their previous education to say, well, you know, we learned that kind of stuff just can't
happen. I think, part of like this is like, I think most of these people, if you sat down and just said, instead of wanting to convince them of the historicity of the resurrection, just ask what they thought about Christianity, what you would find are all the things you guys were suspecting, like the emotional reasons not to like it, maybe some political American Christianity's mean and nasty reasons, hypocrites, my parents were Christians and they beat me kind of stuff.
They looked at me askance. Nobody beats their kids anymore, right?
Wow, I've heard that.
That's not true. Children do get abused. I was being hyperbolic.
How much do you think this is? I mean, it's those reasons, but bottom line, it's just Christianity's not cool.
No, I actually think it's kind of we're doing.
He thinks it's Christianity's mean.
I think that, and I think part of it is like. I think if you were to get them to give a theological reason instead of just like the hypocrite reason and everything, I think it would boil down to your classics, why some, not others, why, how could a religion, how could a God that loves people not save everybody?
What I think is they would have what going on in the background, though, is that Christianity was the predominant, or sort of Judeo-Christian ethical foundation was the predominant cultural force. And this is literally postmodernism at its deconstructive best, because these same people will often make allowances for Islam, which is much harsher towards their position.
Yeah.
Than we, than Christians are.
I agree with some of that, but I think, and you know, we're doing episodes on Out with God right now about what Luther called and Paulson has like highlighted called predestination sickness. And it's a lot of these questions. Why does God love some people and not others? Why did God let my mother die, but not that person's mother die? Mm-hmm. Why did God, and how could a Christian ever face that? And the thing is that our temptation is to like always just sort of answer with some people are good, some people are bad, some things happen for random reasons and not random reasons, instead of doing what we have the power to do, which is tell them that God has chosen them, right? Kind of lean into preaching the gospel to them, that Christ, you know, atoned for all sin, including theirs, and he has chosen them, and that he's put you there now to tell them that. And kind of stuff. I mean, that's hard.
That's a good Paulson answer, though.
Imagine getting the gumption to actually tell somebody that Christ chose them when they're telling you why didn't God choose some people, right? And that's sort of one of the, I think, knowing the position is not always going to be what we suspect it is, or going in with a different mission based on...
I'm just speaking from experience when I have had these conversations. I'm trying to think of a time I've ever said, I think I have actually once. I've told the story in a talk, but most of the time these conversations go to the other. They go to the conversation about Christ and who he is and what he did. And that's where sort of this sort of dismissal kind of comes in. At any rate, I don't know how that relates to reading things with which you disagree.
I just think it's about being, like I was saying, I was unprepared when this guy asked us. It's part of the answer is like knowing what other concerns people have that are out there.
Yeah.
Right. Are not always the ones you think they're going to have or other people are going to have.
Or even the versions of the one that you think they're going to have.
And as time goes on, like Adam was saying, some of these arguments are way less sophisticated than they're being propped up to be, and it turns out some of the concerns have always been there. Things like why did this God not end sin and death right now? Why did he do it the way he did it? Kind of questions have been around forever, but you may be seeing a resurgence of like emotional anger at God versus skepticism that God exists.
Oh yeah,
kind of stuff. And so it's just if you're not reading the stuff you disagree with. You may only pick one of those positions that your position is strong against.
Correct.
I may only pick that what I'm strong against, what my camp is strong against is, people who deny the resurrection, or I may only pick, and this happens in other cases, right, that my camp is strong against people who have a hate for God, but I don't know how to answer for the resurrection,
right,
kind of thing. And that's just reading things you disagree with will make you realize that there, it's not just your position against one position. It's probably what you believe against a million things. And you probably can't be specifically prepared for them all, but you could be more aware that they're out there.
All right.
Well, good. You guys good with this episode?
I am. I'm looking forward to the next one.
I think the next one will be cool. Uh-huh. Next week is a Father's Day episode. I think we should plug this even before that. If you're looking for a Father's Day present to add on to the things that you're giving Dad this year, I think you and you haven't already owned this, you haven't already given this as a gift, I think you should look at my father's book, Being Dad, sold at the 1517 shop and on Amazon. I think it's our best-selling book at 1517 still. It certainly was.
Sure about that. A couple of Chad's books are really selling.
Yeah, some books really do sell, but Being Dad was for years our best-selling book, and it was for good reason. You went on a lot of speaking tours and stuff like that. That book is got a subtitle, Father as a Picture of God's Grace, and the book is very much about the impact fathers have on the faith of their children. I think It's a very interesting read for any father and I think for any kind of family to consider the ideas in there, especially if you care about passing your faith on to the next generation. So that's a great Father's Day present. I'll put a link in the show notes there. And then next episode, we are going to do a little more Father's Day themed type of topic. So All right. We will catch you next week. Bye.